in buildings. So one of the things is that buildings are often made of natural materials. They're made of stone, they're made of wood, they're made of things that grow in nature. And if, in fact, we understand how those things develop in nature and the organic growth and shapes and forms that they have in nature, then maybe it makes sense for when we employ them in buildings that they also have some of those same forms associated with them. So one thing is that it's just a very appropriate thing given our use of materials in architecture. A second thing is that there are forces of nature out there that are organic in a certain way, like the way the wind blows, the way the sun moves through the sky. These are the forces of gravity. These are natural forces that often have a kind of organic quality, and if you understand them, they begin to make a kind of shape in the building as well. So there are these natural forces of wind and rain and other kinds of things. Okay. A third thing is buildings are made for human beings. In our patterns of movement, in the way we use buildings, often there are organic movements and functional requirements that are appropriate to these shapes. So we actually don't, as human beings, we don't walk around in a geometrical way, and then turn, and I mean, maybe the military, but not very many. I mean, the way we move is a more organic, flowing, dynamic kind of way of moving. The way we accomplish functions, the way we gather, the way we relate to each other, the kinds of shapes that would be generated from that are often kind of organic shapes. And the fourth thing is we are organisms ourselves. Our physiognomy is such if you want to interface with our bodies, you probably would make something that was more organic rather than geometrical because our butts are not geometrical. They're organic. Our legs, our arms, how we interact with a building or a table or a chair or these things are probably more organic in shape or form than they would be geometrical. So there are these four things we can think about. And as just a quick example of this, I want us to look at these really, really ancient and very interesting buildings in the central part of Turkey. This is in a region of Turkey called Cappadocia, and it's in the very, very center of Turkey. It's in the middle of freaking nowhere. And these days, probably, you really might not want to go there. It's a little dangerous in eastern Turkey and a little bit in the center here. But this is where, in biblical times, this was the cradle of civilization. And, you know, there were people here, you know, 5,000 years before Christ, major cities and civilizations here, the Hittites and others. So this is an ancient, ancient place where people have been building for many years. And you can see the shape of the mountains in this area. So they're made out of stone. It's a really soft stone. It's called tufa stone. And over the years, you can see how the uplift of the geology, and you can see how the rain and the wind over many years have shaped these very evocative, organic, beautiful, actually, forms in the landscape there. And what happened is that people came in here, and you can barely see it through there. We're going to focus on it a little more. But what they started to do was instead of building houses, they simply carved out houses from the tufa stone there. So they're hollowing out, and you can actually take a spoon and you can scrape on this stone, and it's so soft that you can hollow out very easily from this stone. It's still relatively strong structurally, but it's very malleable. It's very easy to work. So what people have done is they've come in and they've hollowed out caves or houses in the landscape there. So I'm making the argument that nature made certain forms, and those forms had to do with the materials, one of those four things we talked about. So that now the architecture is going to respond as nature responded to this soft stone, then they're going to be making their buildings respond to the same characteristics of those materials. And then just as the rain and the wind made certain forms on these as well, they're going to make forms that are compatible with that too. And then as they begin to inhabit them, they think of, you know, people moving from here to there, and you begin to see the kind of flow of moving up and a stair and around and through, and you get that sort of organic shape of a village beginning to grow here, but in a way that's very compatible with the way people live and move. And then as you actually move into their homes, then you can see it really responding to their physiognomy. These are little places for people to sleep. And so the length of it has to do with the length of the body. And it then when you sort of sit up in bed, this is how tall you are, and your head's a little taller. When you're lying down, you don't need that head height where your feet are. So all of those shapes have to do with our bodies and the way we move our bodies. And so the entire conglomeration of buildings here has to do with the materials. It has to do with the wind and the weather and forces of nature. It has to do with the way people move through spaces. And it has to do with the physiognomy of their bodies. And all of that has shaped very naturally the character of that place. Now, let's take a completely different natural environment. Completely different. Other side of the world. Now we're in Bangkok in Thailand. Bangkok's a very interesting city. It's kind of screwed up at the moment. I went there, 30 years ago, and I just thought, this is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. It's amazing. I went there 4 or 5 years ago, and I thought, they kind of spoiled their nest here because it's got a big population explosion. A lot of what was wonderful about the city is gone. But it was often called the Venice of the East. Probably Venice was the Bangkok of the West, more appropriately, because Bangkok has been this way for a really long time. But it's based on waterways. So you get around in the city through waterways, through the old city of Bangkok. And it's a very tropical climate. And there is not the kind of tufa stone or anything like that to build with. Instead, they have lots and lots of trees. So things tend to be made of wood or sometimes of reeds or fibers that you see in the trees and in the organic matter that grows in this tropical rainforest kind of climate. So now we're in a completely different natural setting. And so if we learn from that, it's going to create certain natural forms responding to it. So let's focus for a minute just on the tiniest kind of form of architecture, these little hats that the women are wearing there. These are called knobs, G-N-O-B. And it's a very characteristic hat that they have worn for centuries in Bangkok. It's made of a local fiber. So they're harvesting this fiber and they're weaving it. And when you weave that fiber, it makes a certain supple kind of curve in it. And it also, because it's woven, it can breathe a little bit. So it gives you a little ventilation. It can give you, for this hat, it gives you shade, but you know when you put a hat on, a lot of times it also makes you sweat like hell around your head, and it's not all that comfortable. The hat actually sits away from your head a little bit, and it's kind of suspended up there, so it can breathe, and so this fiber, the air can move through there. So it gives you the shade, but it gives you the breathing capacity there too. So the materials are making this woven shape. The forces of wind and heat and so on, they're making the shape so that it gives ventilation as well as giving the shade and protecting also from the rain. It's almost kind of like an umbrella. It's a very rainy tropical climate. So it's deflecting the rain away. So the shape is coming from that. And it also has everything to do with the physiognomy of your head. It's fitting on top of your head, and it's being the shape of your skull. So, again, it's organically growing out of materials and forces of nature and your own physiognomy. And we can see the same thing in these a little bit larger architectural forms. These are really houseboats. They build their houses on the water. And that makes them able to go from place to place. Their shops are boats often. So you'll see them full of their goods and they're taking them around and selling to people here and there. They'll have whole market districts that are just hundreds of boats all assembled together, and you go back and forth and you buy your goods. Much of the architecture is on the water. Well, when you, again, it's the same kinds of things shape the architecture of these houseboats and shops. So you get those fibers making these supple curves like that. You get the shape of it coming from deflecting the rain, also moving through the water, hydrodynamic shape that will move efficiently through the water. And so it's materials and it's forces of nature like wind and water and so on. But it also is this kind of organic movement of going, making the market, clustering, opening up, getting from point A to point B, and then also human physiognomy as we were seeing there. So all these same forces are now making very different architectural forms there. And that happens in their, big permanent public buildings in Bangkok, just like it does in their more everyday homes and shops. One of the things that's very cool in the ornament here, see those kind of weird spiky things on the top of their royal palace here? That has to do with human physiognomy in a different way. One of the things they're very keen on in Thai culture is dancing. And these beautiful traditional dances. And the women, when they do these dances, there's a movement with their hand where the wrist is turned way back and the fingers are turned way back. And they grow really long fingernails. And that's considered to be incredibly graceful and beautiful. The kind of tapering of your finger, going out to the nail at the end of it. And that's a very beautiful part of traditional dance. And then in the very same way, they take those beautiful, graceful forms and they use that as an inspiration for making architecture at the very highest level in the royal palace. Even their religious structures, these are wats, which are Buddhist temples in a certain way. Not so much about having a ceremony inside the building, but they create a precinct where you have the Buddhist ritual. And again, it's the same damn thing we've been talking about that's shaping these wats. Number one, it's the materials. This is they're masonry buildings. They're heavy. They start small at the top. As the loads accumulate, they get bigger and bigger and bigger to accommodate those loads. You can see the ants in Thailand building out of mud. And it's exactly the same shape. These ant mounds that are round, they could look and see the ants where they're skinny at the top and they get fatter and fatter and fatter at the bottom because it's a stable structural shape for that material, a masonry material. So it's coming from the material. It's also coming from natural forces, gravity, collecting loads, all of that. There also is, in Buddhist religion, there's a ritual of circumambulation. That means that part of what you do to kind of get in the zone as a Buddhist is you would go around the temple walking in a circle, and you would ring bells, and you would say prayers, but it's more about movement. So you have this circumambulation around a cycle. And so the shape of the building is generated by that circumambulation and the shape of people moving around it. And then if you look in detail on the building, you see that there are representations of the human body and even of plants and plant material. So again, relating to physiognomy. These four things, you can see them over and over and over in especially native, authentic, cultures from long ago in other environments. So That's a kind of bottom line to think about as we go through the lecture today. Now, one of the things we're going to focus on is we're going to focus on a period of time when a very advanced culture got really disillusioned with where they were going, and they said, we need to press the reset button. We need to find a new inspiration for art and for architecture and for form in our culture. And we're going to go back and we're going to find that in nature. And this happened in France in the second half of the 19th century. We looked at some paintings earlier by Edward Manet, sort of intellectual sources of form. He was part of this latter 19th century rebellion. I mentioned when we talked about him that there were these fancy pants salons, and all the artists would submit their paintings to the salon, and all the rich fat cats would go, and they'd buy the paintings from them, and that's how the whole economy of art worked. Well, there were a rebellious group of artists who said, I'm sick of painting the fat wives of rich people in the community and, you know, getting a commission, and that's how I pay my bills. Or I'm sick of trying to pander to their taste. I want to do some art that is more real, less about these wealthy people, and more about everyday people in the everyday world. And so this group of artists actually rebelled. They left Paris. They moved out to this little town called Barbizon, to the southeast of Paris. And they went into the Fontainebleau Forest, which was this beautiful natural preserve nearby to Barbizon. And they said, okay, we're not gonna just screw the whole salon thing. We're not participating. Instead, we're gonna paint the sky and the landscape and the rocks and the trees, and we're gonna paint the ducks and the peasants and more authentic life. And we're not going to paint them in the studio. We're going to paint them in what they called plain light. We're going to go out into natural light, natural environments. We're going to take our canvases out there, and we're going to paint in a more natural, real, authentic way. So that really gave birth to Impressionist painting in Paris, in France, in that era. And then a little bit after Impressionism, then you get a group of artists who are taking it maybe one step further, and they're saying, okay, we can not only paint those subjects and paint that light, but let's begin to really analyze natural forces and forms, and how can we abstract that into characteristics that are beautiful in natural form. So this is in the latter part of the 19th century and then verging into the 20th century. People like Edvard Munch, the great Norwegian artist, and he is looking at the natural landscape in Norway, the fjords, the mountains. He's looking at that eternal twilight, very interesting light quality they have in Nordic environments. And in this painting on the left called Starry Night, he's analyzing what's beautiful in the landscape here, not to literally depict it, but to try to understand how do those shapes of the fjords and the mountains, those beautiful, soft, sinuous shapes, how can they inspire me? That light quality, the reflectivity of the water and the sky almost becoming one, how can that inspire me? How can those natural qualities create shapes and forms and light and color that I can incorporate in my paintings? Very much the same thing's happening with Henri Rousseau. Again, a hugely different environment. He leaves France. He goes down to the South Pacific. He's even going further than Fontainebleau Forest. I mean, he's going halfway around the world to find a culture that's unspoiled by the decadence of current French culture. And I want to understand what's really authentic in this environment. And so he's analyzing again the natural environment he's seeing there. And it's things like these fronds, the petals and the leaves of the trees, these long, spiky forms. And he's realizing, whoa, those are kind of like the long, braids of hair on the women. It's kind of like the long toes and long fingers. And so here are all these shapes in nature, in the human body, in the plant material, beautiful shapes I can find in nature. Likewise, the circular shapes of her breasts, of the fruits here on the trees, of the eyeballs of the lions. You know, how do I abstract these and find these beautiful forms that I can observe in nature, and again, use them as an inspiration for beauty in my painting. Now, okay, it's one thing to do that in painting, but could you also do that in three-dimensional objects? Could you find natural forms and reapply them in a way that would be incredibly beautiful in making three-dimensional objects? There was an artist who did jewelry at the time, a guy named Henri Lalique, and he looked at insects. That's a kind of weird, creepy thing, but he was looking at spiders, and he was looking at grasshoppers, and he's looking at all these different insects and how their legs went together. And he thought it was incredibly beautiful how delicate these things are, and he made jewelry, you know, with diamonds and rubies and very expensive stones to make these beautiful pieces of jewelry that had the beauty of an insect. Completely different source of beauty and form. And here we're seeing some of the same thing. This furniture where you get a joint here that almost looks like an insect's leg that comes down, like, I don't know, a mosquito leg or something. You see ornament on furniture that's now vegetative form, flowers, leaves, that sort of thing. And in a way, searching out some of these same characteristics we've been talking about. What is the material I'm making this out of? What about wood? Wood has kind of a grain to it, this linear grain quality of wood. Could I sculpt the wood to kind of emphasize that linear grain of wood? What about metal, which actually starts molten and liquid? Is there a way to really celebrate that liquid quality of metal and make it much more soft and sinuous and delicate in that way? I love this piece on the right. These are just handles on a cupboard, but it's using the grain of the wood. The grain just kind of stretches out and becomes the handle. And it's also using human physiognomy. It's the shape of your hand and the action of pulling, of actually stretching, pulling the door open, and that begins to make the form. These are what's called Art Nouveau furniture. It was at the latter part of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and they're really interested in organic sources of form being applied now to furniture making. Some of these things get to be so kind of, wow, weird and aggressive. They look like they could walk across the room. But they're trying to break the mold of this sort of traditional, clunky, geometric furniture that you're accustomed to. And that was going into light fixtures. I love this one on the left, which is, it's like Texas. It's prickly pear. And the lights are the prickly pear fruit or the prickly pear flower here, but we get the prickly pear fronds right there. Other things that almost seem like blossoms that are now the glass or the light. Again, looking at nature, finding beauty there, abstracting that form, and now applying it to a three-dimensional object. Now you got to think, this is a little challenging in architecture. How are the architects going to do this? We're talking about whole big buildings. But we have a guy, Charles Rennie Mackintosh. He's a Scottish architect, practices in Glasgow. And the guy has this thing for lilies. And he's a beautiful, beautiful draftsman. So he just draws like a dream. And he's so interested in lilies. And he begins to do illustrations for botanical books about lilies and about flowers. So these are books that are analyzing the pistil and the stamen and documenting these flowers. And so the slide on the right is one of those illustrations he's using in a book about these lilies. But he's also seeing these delicate, sinuous lines in those lilies. And then when he does this wallpaper for a tea room in Glasgow, he uses those same sinuous lines as a way of ornamenting this wallpaper. He's searching for forms in nature that he can reapply in an architectural environment. He also designs furniture, and again, these long, thin, attenuated forms of the lily beginning to inspire the forms of these chairs, even the forms of this flatware that he designs, the spoon and the fork. All of those organic sources of form creeping now into an architect's three-dimensional objects. His colleague over in France, Hector Guimard, exactly same time period. All of this is kind of called Art Nouveau furniture, Art Nouveau building. And Art Nouveau meant new art, okay? We're not going to get the sources in the old art. Flush that out. Trash that. We're looking for new art, and it's going to come from nature, and it's going to be more authentic. So Hector Guimard is doing all of the buildings for the Paris Metro. They've just put a subway beneath Paris. Huge, huge infrastructure project. And he did all of the original stations in the Metro. And sometimes a station comes up in a park, and it gets this kind of delicate, organic feel, almost like a spider's web that's making that architectural form. Or on the left, this is in a more urban setting, and these are like flowers that come out and bloom at the end, and that's the light fixture. And the handrails and all of that almost seem like vines and vegetation. So it's being inspired by organic sources of form. Guimard, he's a very prolific architect. He does lots and lots of apartment buildings in the 16th arrondissement in Paris, very chichy neighborhood. And this is a more traditional arch you'd see in the 16th arrondissement, fancy apartment house. And he's just modifying it a little bit. So those columns, instead of being more classical columns, they've kind of got vegetation growing up and growing into the support there. And the gate that's in there is that gate, made out of metal, and understanding metal as a liquid molten thing doesn't need to be geometrical. It can be flowing. And so it's got these interesting attenuated organic shapes. And then he begins to, in the stonework for entries, he loosens them up and makes them more organic and begins to make objects and begins to use stone that's a little more rugged, like it comes out of the ground, really expressing the material, not heavily altered by the hand of man. And then he imagines, he doesn't ever build it, but he imagines, could we make a whole building that's flowing and organic so that when I come in, there's a great open organic-shaped hallway, and then there's a stair, and it's flowing, and it really is like the movement of people up a stair. And the rooms aren't squares or rectangles. They're more soft, flowing, organic shapes. When you're moving, say, from the kitchen through the butler's pantry into the dining room, why would that all be right angles? Why wouldn't that be a flow of people? And when you get to that dining room, why wouldn't it be about all of us gathering around a table? Why wouldn't that be the shape of the room instead of all these dumbass corners? What does that have to do with? That isn't natural. That isn't authentic to the way we live and the way we move. Now, he didn't ever get to the point where he could build it, but the idea is there. And then down in Barcelona, this absolute wild man architect just does it. It's almost like nobody ever told him you couldn't build that way. So he created a whole different kind of architecture, kind of independent of all these other people's. Barcelona's way apart from Paris or the sort of central things happening in Europe. And down there, there's this guy, Antonio Gaudí, real eccentric guy. He never got married. He was a bachelor all his life. He was super, super religious. At a certain point in his life, he sold everything he had. He gave it to the church, and he was a mendicant. He actually was a beggar. So when he would make anything in his architectural office, that went directly to the church. To feed himself, he'd go out and beg on the street to get enough money to pay for dinner. Eccentric, crazy kind of guy, really strong ideas about how he wanted to live. But he did these buildings that were inspired by nature, and not just nature anywhere, but the nature of the region he lived in. He was very, very in love with the Catalan region where Barcelona is located. He lived there all his life. He was very rooted there, and he loved the natural forms of Catalan. So part of what he loved is the Mediterranean coast, which is in fact stunningly beautiful there, and the meeting of the water and the landscape. The other thing he loved was the mountains. So right at Barcelona, you get this intersection of the coast, and then a little bit of hills, and then these beautiful mountains. And there was one mountain in particular called Montserrat, and that actually referred to, it was like serrated mountain. It's this very weird mountain where it like peaks and peaks and peaks and peaks and peaks and peaks. The top of it is like a serrated edge, Montserrat. So he would go hiking up there. It's not too far from Barcelona. I was very inspired by the landscape of the region, the culture of the region, and he wanted to make architecture that just organically came from this beautiful landscape. So this is an apartment building he did in a newer section being developed in Barcelona. It's called Casa Mila, and he saw it as the coastline. This is like the coastline of the Mediterranean, soft, wavy forms. And you can even kind of see the like wave after wave after wave kind of repeating itself as it goes in to the shore. And in plan, he's doing everything Hector Guimard dreamed of doing but never accomplished, but creating very flowing, very loose shapes that have to do with the way you move, the way you live inside this space. So from the street, there are these two kind of sally ports that take you into these amorphous-shaped courtyards. You'd slide up a stair into these courtyard spaces and go to a hallway that took you to your individual unit in there, your bedrooms, your living rooms. They would be very loose, organic shapes. And he did furniture, and he did all kinds of accoutrements that were meant to fit into this much more sinuous, sensual environment. So here we are looking down in one of those courtyards. He also made a roofscape on the top of it, and this was a place where you could go take a walk. So just like you were on the top of a mountain and you were walking around, and there were beautiful views from up there, so you'd go up and down and up and down. And then there are these towers that come up there. So it's like Montserrat. There are these little spiky, serrated things up there. And they're there partly for this beautiful profile, but also they're ventilators. So in your apartment down below, as the air gets warmer, it's a hot climate, the warm air rises. There are these ventilation shafts that take it up. And then the breeze comes by and pulls the air out. And so it creates a movement of air. It's like a fan without turning on a motor that would give you ventilation all the way through the building. So he's using the natural forces of ventilation and air movement. He's using the analogy to the mountains around. All of those things are generating these forms. And then also it's the movement of people. So you're sliding up the stair and sort of dancing through this courtyard space as it goes up. Even something like the gate, it's not bars, we're not in prison here. This is almost like a spider's web, loose and lacy. A different stair that takes you up through the other courtyard on the other side. All the materials, we're making it out of stone. But now it looks like stone that's been on the beach forever and had the water, rough it up and make it rugged texture. And then the shapes of that stone, not blocks, but softer, more amorphous shapes like the rocks on the beach. Even the balcony here and the handrail is like a bunch of seaweed kind of clustered around on these rocks, and it creates the effective function of the handrail there. Again, made out of metal, which starts liquid and could take this looser seaweed kind of shape. Everything in the building is just got a mindset that takes it not from traditional orthogonal way of building, but this softer, looser, more authentic, more natural thing. And that was an ode to the region that he's a part of, the landscape of Catalan. Very much the same thing happening in this commission he got shortly afterward. He had done a big house for the Guay family. They decided to build they decided to build a big park for people in the city. They owned some land at the edge of the city, so you can see the Mediterranean Sea down there. The city of Barcelona is growing up here. Just as it starts to go into the mountains, as the landscape goes up, there was this piece of land, and they gave it as a park to the city and commissioned Antonio Gaudí to design the buildings for the park. So he takes the upper level of the park and flattens it out and makes this big plaza, takes the lower level of the park and takes it under that plaza, and that becomes a huge mercado, a big marketplace down there. In making that big plaza on the top, he makes the edge of it the shape of the seacoast. As you can see the seacoast intersecting with the water there, you can see the shapes of that here. You see the mercado that's tucked up under that now very lively plaza where they have lots of events and festivals, and Barcelona people love their parties, so it's a really great space there. It's made out of materials that are loose and organic, actually. It's like refuse tile, junk tile. Somebody's torn down a building and the leftover tile, the little shards and bits and pieces of it get woven into these organic benches that surround in a very loose way that plaza, and makes places where people's bodies intersect very naturally there. Here, young guy and girl necking, serious necking right there in the middle of the day, because it's so organic, because it fits their bodies so well, don't you think? Or maybe their bodies fit their, we won't go there, whatever. Anyway, it feels inviting to sit and to gather and to group there, where little clusters of people can sit around and interact with each other. In other parts of it, there's actual literal animals, these little lizard-like animals, which are all over in the region, these quirky little lizards that just run all over in Catalan. And he celebrates that in the shape of the fountain, so that the water is coming out of this lizard's mouth. This little kid's reaching in there to fill up his cup so he can have some fresh water to drink. So everything's kind of based in these natural forms. And then as you go into the park, and it rises up, and again, almost like what we saw in Cappadocia, there are these caves that are kind of hollowed out of the mountain, and then there are additional edges. All of that is actually man-made. That looks like it could be a bluff, but it actually is all man-made. And these are little cafes. That sandwich board there tells you there's ice cream in here, and the bougainvillea, but it just is all more like you're inhabiting the ground, the landscape, than actual buildings plopped down on the ground. So this is happening all over in Parkway, this merger of nature and man-made, all of the buildings inspired by these materials, by these natural forces, by the movement of people, and by their physiognomy. So that is inspiration coming from a region, a landscape. It's also possible that the architectural inspiration can come from the site itself, a very specific site. This is a building in Finland. It's by a husband-wife architectural team, Raimi and Raila Pietila. And this was a student union at a campus in Otaniemi, just outside of Helsinki. And this was a competition where this campus is very integrated with nature. It's very, very rural campus. And so they had designated a site in their master plan for the student union. And they had this big competition to select an architect and a design for it. And this young couple entered the competition, and they had looked at this site very, very carefully, and there were several things they observed there. One is that you could see the geology of this particular site in the outcropping of granite that was happening here. Big granite rocks that just popped out of the landscape. So the first thing they did was they just elaborated on those natural pop-outs and built other big granite forms that would be the base of the building. So it's grounded first in the natural granite outcroppings that come from that site. And then they noticed on the site there were trees. It was a heavily forested site. But it's a certain kind of tree that's very tall and skinny. And at the lower part of the tree, it's very transparent with just the vertical trunks. But then up above, it gets a canopy, and it gets much more solid. So they then build a portion of the building that's just the vertical shafts, like the trunks of the trees, through here and through here. And then on top of that, they put a kind of canopy of trees, now made out of copper, which weathers green and is very much the color of the canopy of the trees. So it's the rock outcroppings, the vertical trunks of the trees, and the canopy. And that really is what shapes the architectural character of the building. And it's true from the inside and the outside. You're on this kind of solid base of granite. You look through these mullions in the windows, which are vertical, just like the trees we're seeing outside, very analogous to it, almost like inside and outside merged together. The forest and the natural character of the site inspired the character of the building itself. And that's really magical, where you feel like you're rooted to the earth with the granite blocks, you're viewing out to those tree trunks, and you're sheltered by the canopy of the trees up above. Everything in the building is really coming from this analysis of nature and site and translating that into architecture. Okay, so we looked at buildings by Antonio Gaudí that are really inspired by the region. We looked at this building by Rima and Raila Pietila that's inspired very much by site. Another thing that can inspire organic forms in a building is simply the function, how people use it, what its purpose is. This is a building that is not particularly in a memorable natural region or site. It's a building at Kennedy Airport in New York. It was the original TWA building. Now it's JetBlue terminal at Kennedy Airport. But this was the first building where there were regular flights transatlantic. So it was built in the 1950s. And the whole kind of incredible thing here was that you might be defying gravity and going way over the entire ocean to Europe in one big flight. So that was like phenomenal and brand new thing. So Eero Saarinen, who's the architect for this, is saying, how can I talk about this phenomenal gravity-defying thing of us being able to fly like a bird across the ocean? So he makes a form that's all about flight, all about that function. And in a way, it looks like a bird. In a way, maybe it looks like a dragon. It's like Game of Thrones dragon kind of thing. Maybe it takes more than a bird to fly across the Atlantic. It takes a dragon. But this big winged kind of form that also is really about uplift and flight. So we're coming in from our taxi or our drop-off. We're entering the building there, and then we're taking up into the sky. And the shapes and forms of the building are really depicting that. At the same time, they're talking about their material characteristic. This is concrete, which again starts in kind of liquid form and then is shaped organically to become these great wings. It's also talking about just how you move through an airport. Surges of people ascending, descending, moving through the airport in this very smooth, flowing kind of way that's creating the architectural forms. Very much the same thing in a much more contemporary building. This one, a building in Germany, in Wolfsburg by Zaha Hadid, incredibly renowned Iraqi woman architect practicing in London currently. This building was from 2006. She was selected for this project because she had this way of making forms that that really represented the movement of people. And if you've got a children's museum, man, there are little kids moving all over the place. It also was a site where it had been an empty site and people had walked across in all directions. And if you plop down a big building there, it's going to obstruct their movement. And so she lifted the building up off the ground and she made these passageways through it that are actually depicting all of the desire lines where I want to move from this part of the city to that part of the city. So those organic movements of people are re-represented in the ground floor of the building, and the rest of the building is lifted up above that so it's not obtrusive to that movement. And then from there you move up these escalators flowing into this very dynamic environment up above. You're always moving up and down and seeing out and looking here and there. And you know, it's one of those places that's filled with all these little kids and they're moving in little groups, and all of it seems to be completely accommodated by this fluid, flowing, open environment of the museum. So here in TWA Terminal, in the Fino Science Center, it's really the function that is driving organic forms for the building. Now, I want to have a little pause here. And I want to get a little reaction, just a little reaction. So if you were thinking, I'll give you four options here. One is, I love this organic stuff. This is fantastic. I really feel that kind of connection to body, nature. This is great. Or a second option is, you know, I'm about half-half. I kind of like the geometric sources of form. I see the legitimacy of that. I also see the legitimacy of this. Maybe I'm just kind of equal on both of them. A third thing is, you know, I'm more on the geometry side. I kind of like it more logical, more rational, more predictable. That resonates more with me. Or the fourth thing is, you know, I don't think either of these things really matter much to me. My criteria for architecture are somewhere else. So just quick here, how many people would say, this organic stuff, that resonates with me? Okay, how many people, about half and half, I kind of see this, I kind of like the geometry in the middle. Okay, how many people, I'm a geometry, mathematics, I like that stuff. Okay, how many people, these issues aren't real relevant to me. Okay, that's cool. Now I want a little feedback here. Why would one person feel more comfortable with the organic sides of things? Why would one person feel maybe more responsive to the geometric sides of things? Does it have to do with who we are individually? Like maybe if I'm a really, my forte is physics and calculus, and I'm an engineer, and I like things to be accurate and technical, maybe that makes me lean more toward mathematics or geometry. Or maybe I'm, you know, I love to hike, I love to be in nature, I'm a huge eco person, I really think, you know, human beings have screwed up nature, we ought to be more reverent of nature. I mean, I'm just fishing around here. What makes you feel like one or the other is more resonant with you? So, somebody got a perception on this? Okay. Because I, you know, this is what this class is about to some extent. What is it that you're interested in architecture that makes it seem good to you? Yeah.
Maybe it's more of a right brain versus left brain sort of situation, where you're either more creative and you like the more natural flowing of the organic shapes, or you're more logical and you like the geometry better.
I love that analogy, right brain, left brain. We've all got both sides, and some of us, our right brain's a little stronger, some of us, our left brain's a little stronger. That's a really good connection. I got to say, and some of you are in my creative problem-solving class, this creative word is a little dangerous for me, in that I think you can do mathematical things incredibly creatively, really amazingly fresh and new insight and creative. So I don't know necessarily that organic is more creative and mathematical is less creative, but I totally like this right brain, left brain thing. Really, really great point. So, yeah, what do you think?
So I am definitely not comfortable with math and things like that, but I also really don't like the organic kinds of shapes. I don't know. It's just kind of unpredictable in a way that architecturally, things that are unpredictable are more unsettling for me than other things that are like music that's unpredictable. Uh-huh. Like I like jazz, but I don't like really any of this stuff.
That's really interesting. I mean, I mentioned earlier, there are lots of sources of form. Maybe it's not numbers, mathematics, geometry. Maybe it's not nature, biology, organism. Maybe it's something else. But that's a great observation. Yeah, what do you think?
I was actually thinking that I'm a STEM person, and organic shape actually seems better to me because it seems like the architect thought about how you use the building and perfects it to what situation you're going to do, whereas a geometric shape is kind of like a very bland, just I'm going to use a square that's a square, and it's not really meant for these people to use it that way.
There definitely is something logical about making a building that responds to the way we move or the way our bodies work. There's something really logical about that. And there's maybe something a little more abstract and intuitive about maybe making a cube or making a circle. That might not be so logical. That might actually be more emotive, like the Apple Store thing. It's not very functional. It's really a little bit more just feeling that they're trying to promote. Yeah.
I think that whichever you prefer kind of has to do with the environment that you're comfortable in. So like if you maybe grew up like camping a lot as a kid, you want to sort of get back to that organic form. But if you were like sort of indoor and like, you know,
playing computer games.
Yes. Things like that. You might like the more like precise and geometrical forms.
Well, that probably has something to do with our experience. Let's finish up here with a building that I think does kind of all of the above, like we finished last time with Sheri Banglanara, the capital building for Bangladesh, that kind of incorporated a lot of the geometric notions. This one is a very, very famous building of our own era. This is the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao in Spain. The architect is Frank Gehry, probably the most famous architect in the world practicing currently. I would say that this building is all about its region, it's all about its site, and it's all about its function, and it draws these kind of organic shapes from all of them. Bilbao is a region known for two things in particular. It's right on the coast, northern coast of Spain. It's a big fishing place. They have really great cuisine based on fish. It's a fish place, and Frank Gehry really loves fishes, and so some of these shapes and even the kind of scales and texture and sort of soft, wet quality of it really is like one might see in fish, a huge, huge thing in that region. The other thing they do a lot of here is shipbuilding, so that they have a construction industry that makes these hydrodynamic shapes, these very fluid shapes. So he was able to key into that, and it really does reflect the industry of the area, which is shipbuilding. It also is very reflective of its site. It's on the river here, and the river bends right at this point, and he creates a reflecting pool that also kind of bends around the building. So some of the specific shapes and forms have to do with that bend in the river, the water, the shimmery quality of water, the thinness, the lightness, the sleekness of water, the materials, the textures, the colors, really compatible with the watery, rivery area. And then it also is, it's an art museum where people, like that science museum, they come in from the city, they kind of gather, and then they surge into various different galleries off of that central area. And it really is the way about the way people move through an art museum, kind of cluster at the center in some kind of identity-giving landmark so you don't lose your way as you wander around in the museum. Always returning back to that big open space that gives views out the glass to the river and up the river and down the river and in this very naturally fluid movement and fluid environment of the landscape around it. So I would make the argument that this is an architect, and unfortunately a lot of people think, oh, he's just all about shape. I absolutely think this is a building that's very rooted in its place and in its function, and those shapes come from that. Even he sometimes, I think, makes it seem like they're just, you know, out of thin air, but I think actually they're more rooted than that. Another example is the Disney Concert Hall that he did in Los Angeles, where there are some parts of the building that are offices and administrative functions, and they're very rectilinear, and they're interfacing with the urban grid. And then there are other parts of the building that are about bringing swarms of people in, about music, about performance, about art, about things that are much more lyrical and light. There also are parts of the building that are like a park where you climb on top of the building and you wander through and around, and all of that's very organic, giving you different views out to the city and creating little performance spaces up there. All of that in a very organic way. So again, it can be driven by function, as in the case of Disney Concert Hall. Okay, Twitter card question for today. I'm going to see if you can do as well as you did on the Twitter card question last time. I want you to think of a building you've experienced or you've seen pictures of or you know of that has its inspiration in organic sources of form. Something that was generated by, something that was provoked by, something that seems to have an affinity for nature and biology and organisms. Anna is ill today, so if you guys could give your Twitter cards to Sean right there, he'll collect Twitter cards for Sean and for Anna.